Okay, so this morning's talk is titled The Middle Way and Provisionality. And it's one of the kind of talks in the theme of the middle way that I've slipped into. Yeah. And so the talk will go like this. I'll start off talking about where my interest in this started, which I probably spoke of last time I gave a talk. And then I'll talk about the middle way's relationship to what I'm calling provisionality. Then I'll just give two teachings where I think the Buddha kind of highlights this idea of middle way and provisionality. And then we'll look at just ways in life to work on this, ways, parts of our practice, parts of our life that we can use to really incorporate our understanding of provisionality into the way we respond to life. So, and then we'll have questions. Or we'll look at questions that arise out of this idea. Okay, so as I spoke about in my last talk, the way I got interested in the middle way is really through looking at the Buddha's first sutta, which is where he introduces the idea of the Four Noble Truths, or the four understandings, or the four actions. And before he even talks about it, he kind of introduces it by speaking of the middle way, and people often gloss over that, thinking, you know, the Four Noble Truths are the go. And so, but I think he spoke of provision of the middle way first as a way of kind of introducing the mindset that we need in order to look at the four truths. Yeah, so he's sort of introducing a mindset, because that's how I think of the middle way, is really as an orientation of your mind as opposed to a belief or a philosophy or anything like that. And in that sutta, I won't read it, I think I read it last time, but in that sutta he said there are two dead ends or extremes, depends how you translate the word, that shouldn't be pursued. So he's saying you don't need to go to extremes, because you know, that stops you from progressing on the path. And the two extremes he gives are the extremes of addiction to pleasure, or moving to kind of wanting lots of things. And the other extreme is like being an ascetic and giving up absolutely everything. So you can see that would be the extreme in his time that was probably the most controversial. So he's saying having that kind of extreme in your life or in your way of thinking just isn't conducive to liberation. And then he says, I'll quote it, "The middle way, bhikkhus, awakened to by the Tathagata," which is the Buddha, "does not lead to these two dead ends, but makes for vision, knowledge, and is conducive to calming and understanding and awakening and nibbana." So this is how he's speaking of the middle way, which is not going to extremes. "And what, bhikkhus, is this middle way? It's just this noble eightfold path." And then he goes through the eightfold path. So, which is, you know, things like ethics and view and mind training or mindfulness and concentration. So it's like the way we live our life is our invitation into the middle way. And the implications of this is that we don't go to absolutes, we don't go to extremes, we don't say or think this is the truth, or this is really bad, or this is really good, or any kind of extreme, he's saying, causes difficulties. Everything is a process. Everything is a part of a process and a result of a process. So nothing is solid. There's lots of ways we could put that. And the middle way is really the same orientation of mind that we're invited to when talking about dependent arising, or about emptiness, or about non-self, or about impermanence or compassion, all of those things, we can only, as we start to look at that invitation by the Buddha, we can see that this is all really dependent on this keeping away from extremes or the middle way. Okay, so the word provisionality really means the ability to change our beliefs depending on the evidence or depending on our experience. Okay, so some kind of flexibility of mind or response to new evidence. So that's provisionality. You don't take anything as hard and fast. And, you know, we might think, oh, yeah, that's easy, I'm always doing that. But it's actually not that we hold on to a lot of things quite strongly, and despite new evidence, we don't let go of it. Mm-hmm. And the Buddha says that's what causes us problems. We're living in a world that is totally unstable, changeable, dependent on causes and conditions, whereas we spend a lot of time, energy and money in trying to make it, you know, stable, permanent, predictable, and in our control. So this is the way the world is, this is the way we want it to be, and that's where suffering occurs. Provisionality, understanding provisionality, again, we can see why the Buddha emphasises awareness or mindfulness, because the more outrightly aware we are, the more we can see change. The more we can see that nothing is stable. If we just really take our awareness to things, we can see this change and this uncertainty. And then if we see that uncertainty, we can more easily avoid extremes. We can see that nothing is always or nothing is never. And once we are sort of at peace with these extremes, then that's what provisionality is alluding to, this kind of sinking in with the world. I think I've talked about that before, that we're often at odds with the way the world is. So the question that brings up really is, how much can I change if I have new evidence? Like, how able am I to change in response to a new experience or new reasoning, or new evidence? You know, can I really listen to people? Can I really be with something? How flexible or inflexible am I around that, around life? And what is it that stops me from it? What stops me from being so flexible and so going with the flow? And that's a really important question for our practice. What is it that stops me? What is it in my thinking or my way of being, or even in my culture? What is it in my culture or my family that stops me? And, you know, we can talk about this afterwards, but we can start to see implications. You know, if your family has always been, I don't know, a Labour voting family, if your family or your culture has always, prized tidiness, you can see the effect it has on you. You just think that's the truth. Again, we can talk about that afterwards. I'll just have a look at two teachings of the Buddha where I think he invites us in to look at this. One is one of my favourites, which I call the flood, and often the Buddha's image of the far side of the shore is this kind of sense of liberation from this tension that we have in our life. So apparently a diva or a little sort of goddess came to the Buddha and said, "Tell me, sir, how did you cross over the flood?" And he said, "I crossed over the flood without pushing forward and without staying in place." So it was neither that nor that. And the diva says, "But how did you cross over the flood without pushing forward and without staying in one place?" And the Buddha said, "When I pushed forward, I was whirled about. When I stayed in one place, I sank." And so I crossed over the flood without pushing forward and without staying in place. So you can see that idea of you can't come up with a rule, if you stay in place you'll be safe, or if you push forward you'll be safe. You have to use your kind of body and mind to gauge when it's appropriate to do either as a way of crossing over something dangerous. And then it goes on. So for me, of course, that's interpreted many different ways by people who study the sutta. But for me, that's a great example of the middle way. Of you don't have a rule, you don't have a hard and fast, you're constantly judging and making decisions according to the situation. And then you probably all know the raft simile, where the Buddha speaks about crossing the river in the raft. And here it says that this simile is to show that the Dharma teachings, even the teachings, are similar to a raft. So they're for the purpose, they're for one purpose, you know, for crossing over the flood or whatever. And then when you've used them for that purpose, you don't cling on to them. So he's still alluding to the fact that teachings are also temporary. Even something like the teachings are temporary. And then he gives the story. I'll read this one because it's a famous one. Suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water whose near shore was dangerous and fearful and whose further shore was safe and free from fear. But there was no ferry boat or bridge going to that far shore. And then the man collected grass, twigs, branches and leaves and bound them together into a raft. And, supported by the raft and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. Then he might think thus, "This raft has been very helpful to me. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or put it on my shoulders and then I could go wherever I want. By doing so..." Oh, and that's the end of that. "By doing so, would that man be doing what should be done with the raft?" "No, venerable sir," said his bhikkhu. "By doing what would that man be doing? What should be done with that raft? When that man got across and arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, 'Suppose I were to haul it onto the dry land or set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. It is by doing that 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 man would be doing what should be done with the raft.'" So you can see, I think, other people might not think this, but I think the Buddha is showing that even something that was really, really useful and life-saving like a raft, even that needs to be put aside when circumstances have changed. Okay, so that too out of many. Okay, so now we'll just quickly look at places in our life where this has implications, or at least places where we can practice. And then we can have a talk about that. Judgments and discernments. So we've already, I think, talked about this in a few other talks, where we think of it as judging mind or discerning mind. And the two elements that come into play around this are your state of mind. So what state of mind are you in when you're making a judgment? You know, you could be reactive, you could be being protective, you could be being, you know. And so, again, this is a place to take our awareness. And then also the circumstances. So there are times when you do need to be inflexible, when you need to say no, or this is the way it's going to be. There are times, depending on, again, circumstances and what your state of mind is. And then there are times to be more flexible, to allow for a change, etc. But the idea of the middle way is that even when you're being inflexible or solid, there is still the ability to change as circumstances change. So in a way, it's appropriateness. And then we could look at language, the way we use our language. And I think I talked about this in our last talk, where our words, we need to be aware of our words when we talk about something as being the way it really is, as opposed to just the way it appears to be. Or, you know, we talk about something as fat, this is the way it is, when actually it's just an opinion. It's just your opinion based on your history and your story. And then often we go for certainty. You know, I'm really certain about this, certainty. In a way, it makes you feel safer, as against probability, in places where maybe it is, maybe it isn't. And we can see our language around this. So instead of saying this is the way it is or whatever, to use words, phrases like it seems to be or it appears to be. In my opinion, it's like this. Or, well, arguably. So to use words that are indicating a certain amount of flexibility. And you could say it may or it might or it probably will. Using your language to be really attentive to the fact that even something that you hold as solid may well be different tomorrow. And I think I spoke last time about how at school, there's a tendency for those absolutes to be quite mind-setting. You know, if you use language that is, you know, this is bad, then it with little kids it can set people's minds. It can, and I'm sure we've got examples the way we were brought up of it really setting people to be inflexible. So, where I taught, we introduced the idea of ish. So instead of saying, you know, someone was really bad, we're just saying, you know, well, bad-ish. Or, you know, that kid was really mean. Oh, he's mean-ish. He wasn't feeling well and he was feeling threatened. So, you know, and if you put ish on the end of a word, it gives it much more flexibility. So today we were late-ish. And you can see how even a word like late has no flexibility. As soon as you put ish on it, well, you know, nobody got here at midday, but people. So you can see that allowing that in our words gives flexibility. Beliefs is another place that, so we've talked about judgments, we've talked about language, and now we're going to beliefs, which is really a hard place to go for, to have provisional beliefs, especially when we're brought up or we're in a culture that doesn't work like that, or especially when, I was thinking this morning, people I know from places that have been at war for a really long time are often a bit more inflexible, because inflexibility offers safety, you know, so it's if you weren't sure about who were the baddies and who were the goodies, then you're not safe, you're likely to be killed. So, you know, you can see how in places of high risk or vulnerability that people tend to be more solid and not to be as flexible. So I think cultures that have been under threat for a long time, and I've noticed that, are really opinionated and totally inflexible. They're the baddies, we're the goodies. You know, this is what you do when that happens, etc., etc. So a way of, as I said before, a way of really looking at our beliefs is by fostering that awareness the Buddha spoke about, by fostering kind of mindfulness, being able to see things as they happen, etc. So, you know, fostering what we think of as critical awareness about something really shows the limitations of our belief, or at least the kind of falseness of holding on to a belief too tightly. Always having, fostering a little bit of kind of healthy doubt is what is spoken of to be really useful with working with provisionality and criticism, and being against dogma. Again, you can see where dogma really helps. It really helps people to feel safe and right. But, you know, we have to be aware of, so often we will sacrifice being true to being right. It's much more important for us to be right than it is for us to be really true to what's going on. I know a lot of people like that. The ability to look at both sides. It doesn't mean you have to be on both sides, but just the ability to see the other person's point of view, where they're coming from, their history with something. So that practice of really looking at both sides. And being encouraged to do this autonomously. Now, we're human beings, we're pack animals, we're primates. So we're very affected by the group we're in. And I'm not, the invitation is not to constantly be breaking away, because there's disadvantages to that too, but just to be aware of that, how our opinion, our stance is really affected by who surrounds us or by our history. You know, we can look at all sorts of things on that around even something like voting. If everyone in your group votes a certain way, votes for Labour or whatever, and then you suddenly decide, oh no, I've listened to both sides, I'm going to vote for Liberal or, I don't know, Pauline Hanson or someone. You can see how difficult that would be if all your friends are doing otherwise. And, I know personally, I'm very swayed by that. I do tend to do whatever my friendship group, is interested in. So just to be aware of that, and to be weighing up the pros and cons of something, and to notice the effect of the group on your decisions. And to have a look at the habit of mind that is involved in that. There's a lot of habits of mind that we don't want to let go of, that are embedded in something like our reputation. We might have a reputation. We don't want our reputation to be changed if we change our mind. Allegiances, all your life you've been allegiant to, a loyalty, and where that is going against something that you believe is true. And even property, things that you own that you don't want to let go of, because you feel safe holding on to a large amount of property or a large amount of things. That can also be challenged too. And then there's a whole area that's called optionality, where we kind of train our mind to see options. And this involves a kind of a mind training beyond just being mindful or aware. This involves the imagination, really. This involves really being creative, allowing a mind that goes beyond the box and fostering that. And if you have a mind that really plays the imagination, this is where, I've spoken of this before, people talk about mind wandering as being a kind of a, or daydreaming as being kind of a negative quality. Well, I don't think it is. I think it allows us to have a more creative mind, a mind that explores more options, that stops us from being stuck. If we allow our mind to roam freely and fantasize, etc., it prevents stuckness. And in the middle way society, there's a big aspect, because there's a society called the middle way society that really explores all these things, and they really emphasize imagination and creative thinking and allowing your mind to expand in. And like I said, to have a look at habits of the mind, ruts of the mind, and we're so used to thinking a certain way that it's very hard to think differently. And places where we limit ourselves or have been limited by others in our past, our parents or our culture or our school. And in the Middle Way Society, they encourage you to what they call explore weak links. So your mind might be in a certain rut because of the way you've been brought up, this is an encouragement to go somewhere where you haven't gone before, a weak link, a place where you haven't been creative or imaginative or something like that. And then adaptivity, allowing yourself mistakes. Again, I've talked about this before, allowing yourself to make mistakes, to take a risk, and to see a mistake as a place of learning or mind expanding as opposed to something bad. Mistakes aren't bad, they're places of learning. You can only get there by taking a risk. So this adaptability of mind can be fostered by this taking a risk and changing our approach to mistakes. The word messy is often used. There was a radio program on the other day where someone has looked at the phenomena of messiness, he calls it, and it really fits into this whole idea of preparing ourselves to be provisional, is allowing mess, allowing mistakes. And the program had so many examples of where terrible mistakes had been made, you know, ostensibly really terrible mistakes, and they turned into something absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And one, the example was, what's the name of that piece of music? Keith Jarrett?
Oh, the Cologne Concert.
Yeah, the Cologne Concert, where, it's a very long story, but the young girl who invited Keith Jarrett to play at Cologne, the piano, they'd moved the wrong piano. There was this really bad piano there. It wasn't the baby grand that was supposed to be there. It was this really terrible piano, and he said, I'm not playing it. I can't play that. It'll destroy my reputation, and went and sat in the car. And she was only a teenager, actually, who organised this. And she went out and absolutely pleaded with him. People were rolling out. There were, you know, it was Keith Jarrett, so there was, I don't know, hundreds of people. And she pleaded and pleaded with him. So he went back, and he stood up, and he had to use a lot of, because this piano had no resonance or something, so he had to use a lot of force. He couldn't go up that end because no one would hear it, so he stayed down this end, and he did a lot of banging and things that he'd never done before. He left bits out that involved those tones that nobody would hear, and there's a lot of groaning on the tape, and Mark's actually got the piece of music. Well, it was. It's become really famous as being the most amazing piece of music ever played. And he wasn't. It was only because he was willing to go somewhere where he really didn't want to go. So that's just an example. And I'm sure we've all got examples in our life where, you know, that has happened, where we've taken a risk and we thought it was a terrible outcome. I mean, I've got examples in Dharma talks. I've done Dharma talks off the top of my head, and I've gone and into my room thinking, you know, that was terrible, and, you know, I've got the feedback that it really landed, and I thought it didn't. So, you know, I'm sure you have examples too. So the questions that arise out of this, you know, one is really, what parts in your life aren't provisional? And I was talking with a Dharma teacher friend of mine and said, you know, everything's provisional. He said, oh no, I've got a few things that aren't. Said, like I'm always kind, like I would want to always be kind. And I say, well, if you say that's not provisional, that's really limiting you to a, you know, like what if someone came in and was hurting a child or something, or, you know, was damaging someone or something right in front of your eyes, you know, you would use all your force to stop that. Or someone was going crazy and you needed to prevent them from hurting themselves. There's all sorts of examples you can think of. So even within something like I will always be kind, there's still a provisional element. And we talked about this at our retreat, where we have something like precepts, like thou shalt not kill or steal or say rude things, has to be provisional because there's always an exception. So the questions I've got here that we could explore now is, you know, are you often aware of assumptions you're making? Do you often stop and think, you know, is this an assumption that I'm doing out of habit? What beliefs do you take for granted? Are you aware of criticisms of those beliefs that you hold true? And do you have ways of cultivating those weak links through arts or travel, or, you know, going to places you wouldn't normally go, or all of those places that stretch our imagination or broaden our experience, I should say. And Do you notice unchallenged judgments in yourself and in others? And where are you flexible or inflexible? So they're all questions we could, look at now and explore the implications of this. Because, like I say, it's not really a philosophy. It's an orientation of mind, of really understanding that everything is provisional, and the times we make it not, what is happening there in us? What's the protectiveness, or what's the what's happening in our mind that freezes us or cements us? Okay, well, I'll open it up to discussion now.